You know, Paul, I don't know if you remember this, but last year, it wasn't that fun for me having that broken neck.
Go on.
But you know, Paul, at least now I can look back and laugh.
All right.
I don't get it.
I don't know if I get it either.
I'm assuming because you're so mangled that you can look at your own back. I'm not really
sure. Yeah, I was thinking maybe something like that. So, Paul, what you got anything?
So, shout out again to punsteria.com, which just has, it reads like it was translated from a foreign language into English, unwell by AI. But the one I like the best is, I used to hate smoking, but I finally decided to ask for forgiveness. That one's actually not bad. When it comes to smoking, it's important to have a light sense of humor. I feel like you guys aren't laughing the way that you could be with these.
No, that's good.
What do cigarettes and batteries have in common? This is my favorite one.
I don't know.
They both have a positive and negative terminal. Can you tell me what that means? Because I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, I think we've struck out on this one, Paul.
All right.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders. I'm Dr. Matthew Frank Watto, here with my great friend and America's primary care physician, Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Hey, Paul.
That's a throwback, hey, Paul. Hi, Matt. How are you?
I'm doing well, Paul. This is a hotcakes episode, and we have a lot of great topics to talk about tonight. We're talking about e-cigarettes, should we or shouldn't we be using them? Talking about gabapentinoids and COPD exacerbations, something I'd never heard of. A little bit of lidocaine patches and do those things work? And a couple other fun topics, some C. diff antibiotics. And what's the last topic there? Oh, yeah, GLP-1 agonists. And should we be dosing them by clicks? So we'll get into all that stuff. Paul, before we do, and before we introduce our wonderful co-host, can you please tell people what is it that we do on Curbsiders?
Sure, Matt. Thanks. We are the Internal Medicine Podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. Usually, but as you mentioned, this is our hotcakes episode. So instead, we have one of our own experts, our resident epidemiologist and smart person, Dr. Rahul Ganatra, who's going to make sure that we're actually reading these things correctly and taking away the right takeaway points. Rahul, how are you?
I'm great. How are you all?
I'm good. It's kind of close as we're recording this, as this is coming out. You know, ACP is coming up in Boston, and we're going to be able to hang out in real life, Rahul, which is something that happens maybe once a year these days. So that's exciting.
Very excited.
And I think I hear Paul's cat in the background also very excited.
You sure don't. That's
my child.
And that may be a child. Yep. I think they call that audio verite. So let me remind the audience that this and most episodes are available through VCU Health for CME for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. And also, if you haven't done so yet, you really need to join our Patreon at patreon.com/curbsiders, where you can get ad-free episodes, bonus episodes twice a month, access to the Cash Slack vault with all our show notes and figures, really, really wonderful stuff, and access to our Discord, where you can chat with the great Paul Williams himself and a bunch of other really cool people who listen to the show. So with that, Paul, would you like to introduce the first article?
I'd love to. As I, in case you couldn't figure out from the pun, this was the article on e-cigarettes. So this is from Auer et al., Electronic Nicotine Delivery Systems for Smoking Cessation, which is from the New England Journal of Medicine in February of this year. And this substantial group of researchers were asking, does the use of e-cigarettes, in addition to standard of care cessation counseling, lead to an increased rate of abstinence from smoking? So basically what they're asking is, can we use e-cigarettes or counsel patients to use e-cigarettes to help quit smoking? And the reason this is relevant, I'm not sure how it is for you all, but I know for my patients, even those who smoke cigarettes, many of them also vape. Many of them have used e-cigarettes to try to quit smoking. Patients will often come in with their e-cigarettes kind of hanging around their neck or in their pockets, readily available. So, and the rates are going up. So I think it does behoove us to be able to counsel our patients about the safety and frankly, if they're going to be using it to quit smoking, if there's any evidence to support that, and if it's as safe, better than smoking, worse than smoking. There's a recent study I looked at that people perceive electronic cigarettes to probably be even less safe than they actually are, which is interesting. So people might not even think of them as tobacco cessation aids much of the time. So I think this is an important study to help us counsel our patients in those regards.
Paul, this is like for me in primary care, if people are thinking about or trying to quit smoking, I just assume they've tried e-cigarettes because it seems to be pretty common when I ask people. And some of them are like, oh yeah, I quit smoking. I'm like, oh great. And then I forget to ask and they're like, yeah, I vape now. So,
yep.
Yeah. And so we'll talk about that. So what were the top line results of this study? And then we'll get into the details.
Yeah. So your takeaway from this was a positive study. So what they were looking at as a primary endpoint was biochemically validated continuous abstinence from smoking at 6 months out from their quit date. And this occurred in 28.9% of individuals in the intervention group who got the e-cigarettes and in 16.3% in the control group, which is still not bad numbers, to be honest with you. But the patients in the intervention group, those who were using electronic cigarettes, were more likely to be using nicotine by the end of the study. So not smoking cigarettes, mind you, but using nicotine products. And there was no difference in the serious adverse events between the two groups, but there were more adverse events seen in the intervention group. And we can get into how they measured that and what that means necessarily. But by and large, the patients who used e-cigarettes were more likely to be done with cigarette smoking by the end of the study, which I think is important.
Is this the one where they gave people the vouchers that they could use for nicotine replacement therapy if they wanted to?
In the control group. That's right. So both groups, exactly. So the way this is an open label randomized trial, and they randomized patients in a one-to-one fashion to either the control or the intervention. So the control group, a study nurse gave them counseling, and then also they got 50 Swiss francs at the beginning of the study to do with what they will. So, you know, ideally they would use it for nicotine replacement therapy or varenicline or some other, because they were counseled about the various medications used to quit smoking, but they didn't have to. And then in the intervention group, they were they were given electronic cigarette kits. They were also allowed to sort of sample the smorgasbord of nicotine products. So they were 6 different flavors and 4 different concentrations. So they could sample up to 24 different varietals of e-cigarette stuff. And that's the one that they actually used to help themselves quit smoking, ideally. And then they evaluated these folks at 1, 2, 4, and 8 weeks after their target quit date to see how they were doing, with the ultimate end result being measured at 6 months with biochemical abstinence and then also some more interview stuff.
Yeah, Paul, I was very curious about this because when people tell me they're using nicotine with and they're vaping e-cigarettes with nicotine, because I guess you don't have to, but it seems like most people do. Mm-hmm. Those pods come in different strengths. And like, I think from what I could read, when you smoke a cigarette, you don't get all the nicotine that's actually contained in that cigarette. It's just a small amount. And if you smoke like a pack of cigarettes, you get like 20 or 30 milligrams of nicotine. And they said that those pods have about like 40 milligrams of nicotine. I think they come in 35 milligrams or 50 milligram pods. So if you smoke like the whole pod of nicotine that goes in your vape device, then it's like smoking a pack of cigarettes as far as the nicotine content goes, which I had never really like took the time to look into that before, but it seems they're getting nicotine, which I think will factor right into what we're talking about here.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I struggle with in terms of vaping counseling is exactly like, oh, so you vape, how much do you vape? And then the patients are going to be like, I don't know how to answer that. I'm like, is it a 6% cartridge? That's the thing I heard of one time. Like, they don't know. It's just kind of a mess in terms of quantifying, but it's, I think that's a helpful framing, Matt.
Yeah. So can we get into the limitations? So this was a positive trial. So I guess we need to look for sources of chance or bias that might've led to that outcome. I don't know if we want to phone Rahul for this, since he's always good with those,
I want to mention a couple of points about the trial, sure, that I just think were kind of nifty. And then I will cheerfully tag in Rahul. Let me know if there's bias or I should be sort of skeptical here. So the biochemical confirmation was actually done. The patients just brought their urine into the office, which is, you know, having worked in addiction medicine clinics, is typically not how you do urine testing for anything, which I'm not saying that people brought in fake urines, but I am saying it's not perfect. But the adherence was confirmed measuring adnabazine, which I had never heard of. Have you heard of this, Matt?
No.
It's a tobacco alkaloid. And so what it can do is you can actually detect whether someone's been smoking, even if they're using nicotine replacement therapy. So it's not a nicotine metabolite. It's independent from that. So you can see smoking without it being interfered with by nicotine, if I understand correctly. So it measures smoking tobacco, not nicotine concentrations, which is what's usually in the the standard urine drug test. So I thought that was kind of cool. I did want to touch on the exclusion criteria. And then, Rahul, I'd love to hear your thoughts in terms of the strengths and things that maybe we should just look for bias. But I did note that the patients who were excluded, if you look at them, upwards of like 85% had tried to quit previously, but the exclusion criteria included folks who had not used electronic cigarettes in the past 3 months or nicotine replacement therapy in the past 3 months. So I thought it was, in terms of selection bias, which I hesitate to even call it, it's a curious group who advocate, who are interested enough to call a number and participate in a research trial, but have nevertheless not tried electronic cigarettes or nicotine replacement therapy in the past 3 months. So I'm not saying that invalidates anything. I just think that's, I feel like that selects for a certain type of person that I can't characterize entirely well. But I think this overall was a strong study, but I would love to hear Rahul's thoughts in terms of how they did it. And if there's anything I should be curious about before I go advocating for nicotine for e-cigarettes for all of my patients.
Yeah. Well, I thought the same thing when I looked at the participant characteristics, but then I sort of thought about, well, I wonder if practices around e-cigarettes are different in, you know, Switzerland than here. Maybe the marketing is, you know, more aggressive here. But, you know, thinking about sources of chance and bias that could explain a positive trial finding. So I love that framing, starting off, this is a positive trial, meaning an association was found between the intervention and the outcome. So the first thing that I look for when I'm evaluating a positive trial is the primary outcome history on clinicaltrials.gov. And for this trial, the primary and secondary outcomes that were registered in the protocol are the same ones we see in the paper. So that's good. And then the next thing I look for is there obvious evidence of selection bias? And a great place to find this is in the consort diagram, which in this study is figure one, that flow chart where they show you, you know, the number of patients who were assessed for eligibility and the number of patients ultimately randomized. A quick and dirty dipstick method that you can use to sort of get a sense, was this a highly selected study population or was this a very, you know, open arms recruiting type of study, is what was the percentage of patients who were screened who are ultimately randomized? And in this study, you know, because I'd be more worried about a study where like, you know, 5% of patients who were screened were ultimately randomized than I would be about a study where 95% of patients who were screened were randomized. So this study, like most studies, falls somewhere in the middle. It was, you know, more than half of patients who were screened made it in, which is good. So there's not a glaring signal for pre-randomization selection bias. Mm-hmm. And then post-randomization selection bias, you can also look for in that diagram. And you can see here, 600 patients and change were assigned to each group, and the same number of patients were included in the primary analysis. So that tells you it was an intention to treat analysis. So, you know, absence of red flags for sources of chance and bias for this positive trial.
Yeah. So Paul, anything else you want to talk about in this one? I mean, I think there's a little bit more discussion beyond this to just say, like, how is this going to change our practice? Because there was some interesting editorials that have been written in the past couple months, about, and one went along with this. So what do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to dig into here. So the inclusion criteria included people who had intended to quit within 3 months. And so, you know, this is actually a little bit contrary to sort of how I actually counsel patients to quit smoking. Like, if someone's even thought about it or even mentions, like, maybe some point I'll quit, I start encouraging intervention and pharmacologic modalities immediately. Like I don't rely on quit dates anymore. And so it just, even in terms of the framing of things, it's a little bit different than I actually practice. But I guess the bigger question we should be talking about is we're kind of working under the assumption that electronic cigarettes are safer than cigarettes and are a better alternative to it. Like otherwise, what's the point? Like if it turns out they're more harmful than cigarettes, then there's no reason to actually be conducting this study at all. And I think that's the part where we're kind of tripped up. And we were talking about before we started is there's not a lot of super compelling trials looking at really long-term data in terms of people who've used electronic cigarettes and their long-term safety. There's sort of shorter-term stuff, but the longer-term, it's hard to feel super comfortable with, though probably on balance, they're safer than smoking tobacco.
Right. So a couple things that we looked at for this, there's a Cochrane review. It's a living review of e-cigarettes. And this, it was most recently updated in 2024. And they basically conclude that e-cigarettes are, you know, the adverse events are things like nausea and throat irritation. You know, there's nothing serious there. That Cochrane review says there's pretty good evidence that it works better than just nicotine replacement therapy, your standard nicotine replacement therapy, and better than e-cigarettes without nicotine. The e-cigarettes with nicotine work better. And this editorial in the New England Journal by Dr. Rigotti, she at the end sort of concludes, we have to start thinking of e-cigarettes as a tool for smoking cessation. And especially if patients have tried other first-line agents, you know, your varenicline, your nicotine replacement therapy, and they haven't had success, then this is something we have to think about. So, you know, that's kind of where I'm at for now. I haven't heard any really bad long-term adverse events, but Rahul, I know you were mentioning you had read something recently about this.
Yeah, there was just a systematic review and meta-analysis published in February in NEJM Evidence, which we can link in the show notes. And this basically looked at a lot of observational studies of patients using e-cigarettes to look at the comparison of outcomes for different endpoints between patients who are still using tobacco products and patients who are using e-cigarettes to get at that assumption, are e-cigarettes really safer? And what they found is that for cardiovascular disease, stroke and metabolic syndrome, there was really no improvement from switching to e-cigarettes. But for pulmonary things like asthma, COPD, and also oral disease as general category, patients do better with switching to e-cigarettes. So it does seem like there's some need for individual nuance and decision-making in advising patients to switch.
This episode is brought to you by LocumStory.com. There's a shortage of doctors in America, and locum tenens physicians, they help alleviate that strain. Did you know that 72% of healthcare facilities are now seeking locum tenens physicians? That's almost double what it was a decade ago. There's a lot to learn about the industry, and that's where Locum Story comes in. They are your source for all things locum tenens. You can find interviews on the Locum Story podcast with experts sharing advice about everything from finances to physician burnout, as well as firsthand stories of providers who have worked temporary locum tenens assignments. They'll get into why they work locum tenens, the experiences they have, and the advice they want to give others looking to try it. If you have questions, they have answers, and you can find them by tuning in to the Locum Story podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google Podcasts. That's the Locum Story podcast and locumstory.com. Paul, you were making the point about, like, you know, because that's observational data and looking at cardiovascular risk in the in a person who's using e-cigarettes. What do you think?
So a couple of things. I think the pulmonary benefit's not surprising because you're not inhaling smoke. Like, I think that's really demonstrable. The cardiovascular equivalence, I do hesitate to hang on too strongly because I think that probably unhealthy behaviors tend to ride together. And I think that patients who vape and smoke electronic cigarettes may engage in other sort of less healthful activities or may eat sort of less healthful diets or maybe don't. Again, this is a broad generalization I fully appreciate. But yeah. I would wonder if there are not other factors that might contribute towards contributing to cardiovascular disease that are maybe not necessarily exclusively the electronic cigarettes. Right. That would be my hesitation there.
So this is an association with cardiovascular risk. However, we can't say it's causal. And then was there a mechanism proposed for why e-cigarettes? Was it the nicotine is increasing cardiovascular risk? Or is it the something else, some other chemical that's in the vape? Because you have to have like a mechanism, right, in order for to even suggest there could be a causal relationship. You have to have a proposed mechanism. Did they put one in there? I don't know if you know that offhand, Rahul.
No, it's a good question. First, I'll say, Paul, your concern about could those associations be confounded by other behaviors that are also associated with smoking? Very legitimate concern. And then, Matt, as to your question of is there a potential mechanistic hypothesis for why nicotine might worsen cardiovascular outcomes but not pulmonary ones? This is something where a subject matter expert in nicotine yeah. and smoking replacement therapy would be really helpful. It seems to me like it might be mechanistically plausible if nicotine has, you know, vasoactive properties and, you know, leads to vasoconstriction, might worsen hypertension over time. I could see there being a causal link in there, but I don't know the answer. Mm.
All right. So I think we should wrap this one up. Paul, if you want to give your hotcakes rating for the original article we were talking about, and then let the audience know, like, what do you suggest they do with this information that we've just presented?
Yeah, I guess I'll go, what are we, out of five? I guess I feel like I should note this at this point.
It's out of five.
Okay, yeah, I'll go three. It's not going to change things. I think it adds to, it's an important article, and I think it adds to a body of knowledge that needs to be developed even further still. I think this will fit into the realm of just, it will build the shared decision-making conversation where I would actually probably bring this up, like, on balance, people are more likely to be done with smoking and continue to vape when they try to use vaping to quit. So I think it's important to let patients know what to expect, and the safety seems to be there so far as we know, but we don't have really good long-term data. And I think that's a fair thing to say to patients. I am not going to actively discourage someone from using electronic cigarettes to quit smoking is part of my takeaway. So if someone wants to try it, I think it's certainly reasonable, and probably hopefully I don't look back in 10 years and regret saying this in a recording, but probably safer and healthier. So I think I would not discourage and would even consider using electronic cigarettes to help patients quit smoking.
I like the point that you made that a lot of the patients were still using e-cigarettes, you know, because they remain on nicotine. They don't, it's not like they just use e-cigarettes, quit smoking, and then stop the e-cigarettes. A lot of, like, more than half the patients in this study and other studies remain on them. So I think that's the issue. And you might have to use the traditional methods for smoking cessation to get people off the e-cigarettes. But that's, I don't think anyone has actually published that yet, or, you know, we don't know for sure what to do there.
For Right and Clean, so far as I know, and we can go back and amend this, but actually it has been studied for that. It seems to be the most effective thing that we have.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll make one last point, but it's actually kind of ironic because I think maybe it was the Rigotti editorial that mentioned the history in the States of electronic cigarettes not being used for cessations because they wanted to bypass the FDA process, which is so burdensome. So since rather than being listed as a medication, they just went right to direct to consumer. And this, honestly, this would be a dream medication for a pharmaceutical company, right? Like, this is something that patients would use and then remain on in perpetuity. So it's kind of surprising that someone actually hasn't gone down that route and actually tried it yet, but it's just probably a matter of time.
I think the cigarette companies are already making so much money off of them that they don't even care. But I guess pharmaceutical companies could jump in and make some money too. I don't know. All right. Well, Rahul, our next article is yours. So do you want to introduce it?
Yeah, sure. So we're going to talk about a paper that has to do with kind of the other end of the consequences of smoking, what happens to people who have had a long history of smoking. So this is a paper by Rahman and colleagues, and it was published in a February 2024 issue of the Annals of Internal Medicine. This is gabapentinoids and risk for severe exacerbations in COPD. So the research question that these authors wanted to study was whether gabapentinoid use, which is basically gabapentin and pregabalin, but I'm just going to say gabapentin for simplicity, whether gabapentin use is associated with hospitalizations for COPD exacerbation. So I'm just curious, was this something that was on either of your radar before talking about this paper? Is this something that you had been thinking about?
I have to say, Rahul, we read a lot for the show. We've been doing hotcakes since at least 2018, and this has not been on my radar at all. Shamefully, I did not know about it.
Oh, I wouldn't build shame into it because I think, I don't know, Rahul, like, it was burning up the Twitterverse for all of like 2 days, but even the pulmonologists were like, yeah, I had no idea. So I don't think it's on us. It was not a well-known phenomenon if it didn't need to exist.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it kind of is important to think about, you know, why was this study done? Why is this important? Who cares? So the reason that this study was done is that it's definitely the case that off-label prescribing of gabapentin, at least in the United States, is becoming increasingly common. People kind of think of it as a safer alternative to opioids in patients with chronic pain and other indications for opioids. But it turns out that in the early 2010s, there have been a number of reports of severe and fatal respiratory depression attributed to gabapentin reported to the FDA. And so this prompted a security warning in 2019. But the evidence at that point wasn't great. So this cohort study was done to sort of figure out, you know, is there evidence of harm from respiratory depression from gabapentin? So what did the authors find? Well, in terms of the top line findings of this study, this was a positive study. An association was found among patients with COPD in Canada who had a median of 1.5 years of follow-up. Gabapentin use, when compared with non-use of gabapentin, and this was gabapentin being used for a median of about 6 months, was associated with an increased risk for hospitalization for COPD exacerbation, regardless of whether the indication was epilepsy, neuropathic pain, or other chronic pain. And this translated in absolute terms to about a 40% relative increase in the hazard ratio and an excess of about 7 hospitalizations per 100 patients per year. So, you know, real evidence of harm, both in the absolute sense and the relative sense.
Yeah. And it's so they think it's maybe respiratory depression that's causing part of it. And then I guess you're more likely to have COPD exacerbations as well. I wasn't really clear other than respiratory depression, which makes a little bit of sense to me because they're somewhat sedating medications and there may be polypharmacy going on, but I'm not sure if there's another mechanism.
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. What might be the causal mechanism here? The evidence is scant, but there's at least one study showing that gabapentin is thought to worsen respiratory parameters during sleep in patients with obstructive sleep apnea, leading to more episodes of hypopnea and more hypoxemia. And there's also evidence that gabapentin leads to increased incidence of respiratory depression when given perioperatively. So there's at least two settings in which gabapentin has been observed to cause respiratory issues. And I think we are kind of, not really sure beyond that. And its GABAergic properties, sort of similar to alcohol, could it lead to respiratory depression in high doses similar to that?
Can I put out a proposition that I think other people should study because I'm not a researcher? But recall that gabapentin is actually one of the medications suggested for someone who has idiopathic chronic cough. Like, I wonder if like cough suppression and then not clearing out secretions, like if we're actually sort of suppressing a mechanism that actually kind of clear out some gunk, is not a contribution as well. That'll be my mechanistic proposition. So
please do enjoy that. That's great.
Thank you. Tying together old shows, trying to make it relevant.
Yeah.
What a pro.
Your question about the mechanism and how this might work, though, makes, in my mind, the details of how they did this actually really important, because, if the mechanism doesn't make sense, then, that is an important piece of how we evaluate the findings of the study. So I'll tell you how the study was carried out. This was a retrospective cohort study that was done using an insurance database in Canada. And basically, the authors had access to all the administrative data for pharmacy dispensing for about 40% of the population in Quebec. And they had access to 100% of hospitalization data for the population of Quebec. Okay. So they identified people with COPD using receipt of inhaled medications for COPD, LABAs, LAMAs, and ICS. And they used ICD-9 codes to identify hospitalizations for COPD. Okay. So this means that the outcome is going to be assessed with basically 100% certainty because they have ICD-9 codes for hospitalization. But the exposure is only going to be assessed with about a 40% fidelity, okay? Because there's a huge section of the population that doesn't get their, whose pharmacy outpatient data doesn't make it into this database. So this means that there is going to be misclassification of the exposure in this study, and that is going to tend to bias towards a null finding. So the fact that this study was a positive one, found an association even despite that, makes me worry that, maybe the signal or the strength of association between gabapentin and the outcome is even greater than what we found. They used propensity score matching in this study to match users with non-users on as many characteristics as we could. And then they used something called an active comparator new user design. And basically, that's just a way to try to emulate a randomized trial as closely as possible to avoid some of the biases inherent in observational research. You can think of this as kind of like an intention to treat analysis in a randomized controlled trial. And this will increase exposure misclassification over time, but as we said, that would tend to bias towards a null finding. So that is in my mind, kind of a strength in this study.
Yeah. To me, I guess the big question for America's primary care physician is, Paul, as someone who, and I'm joking when I say this, you're a huge fan of gabapentin. You love it. It's your favorite medication. You give it to most people. Does this change anything in your practice?
I'm a vocal hater of gabapentin in most circumstances, in part, and we talked about this a little bit, because it does seem to be a Hail Mary pass where it is used, as you mentioned, Rahul, off-label for a lot of indications that it's not needed for. And then when it doesn't work, it remains on the medication list. So it gets up-titrated, gets parked, and then patient's renal function change. And then I think there's potential for toxicity and bad outcomes. So I think if anything, I'm struggling with the mechanism. I think any of these sort of chart mining trials, I think you have to interpret with caution, though. This seems about as clean as you can do it. But it's just another reason to be a little bit more cautious when thinking about gabapentin is, well, maybe I'll try it for this patient's whatever pain, because if it's not indicated for non-neuropathic pain and it barely works for neuropathic pain. So like it just, maybe it shouldn't is my takeaway for that.
Yeah. Yeah. The side effects, weight gain, edema, dizziness, vision changes, there's a lot of it can dull cognition for some people. So definitely has a lot of downsides to it. And I think it gets thrown around way too sort of people are just very easy to just be like, oh yeah, let's throw some gabapentin at them. And I think not even thinking about the starting dose either, just be like, oh yeah, start them on 300, three times a day. And they're 90 years old,
Right. And these are multimorbid patients, which means they're going to have variable renal function. And so, and this is a renally dosed medication. And just so often I see someone who declines, but the dose just stays exactly the same. So like, I just think there's so much potential for toxicity already. So to have one more thing to worry about with it should just, again, make you be a little bit cautious with it.
So to get back to this study, Rahul, like what would you give this as a hotcakes rating? And what would be your recommendation to the audience as far as what conclusions they can draw from it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, despite the limitations of observational research that y'all brought up, these authors used robust methods to sort of try and aid in our inference of causality. And this is likely to be the best information we're going to get to try to clarify, you know, is there evidence of harm from gabapentin in patients with COPD. So, you know, my takeaway is that because off-label prescribing is, you know, really of uncertain benefit, and now we're, you know, accumulating more evidence of harm, this is going to make me avoid initiation of gabapentin in patients with COPD, and I'll try other alternatives first. So I'd give this 4 out of 5 hotcakes.
Excellent. All right, moving on to the next. Now, from gabapentin to another chronic pain Hail Mary, Paul, lidocaine. So this is by a study by Cohen et al., and it's a multicenter, randomized, placebo-controlled crossover trial. This was looking at topical lidocaine for mechanical cervical pain or mechanical neck pain. This appeared in the journal Anesthesiology in 2024. And we wanted to do this paper just because, you know, Paul, lidocaine, I wanted to do a little bit of a deep dive on lidocaine patches because in my experience, most patients have tried them. Some patients love them. Some patients say they do nothing, but they're pretty easy for patients to get their hands on, and people love to do something active to try to treat their pain. So the question here was, you know, is lidocaine better than placebo for mechanical neck pain? And this was actually a negative trial. They actually published a negative trial, which I think is, you know, commendable. And this used a topical system of 1.8% lidocaine. And so basically, Paul, these were fancy 1.8% lidocaine patches that are thinner and more efficient at delivering lidocaine, but deliver equivalent amounts of lidocaine to your traditional larger, heavier 5% lidocaine patch.
This ain't your granddaddy's lidocaine patch.
Yeah. And I read like 3 or 4 articles like, kind of deep diving on like how there's, you know, these fancy patches they use in this study need less lidocaine per gram adhesive, and the patches need much less lidocaine to get, you know, the same kind of levels, and maybe they adhere better and maybe the lidocaine penetrates a little deeper. And anyway, so this study found they were looking to see at least a 1 point difference on a 10-point neck pain scale. And they ended up having only about a 0.5 point between group difference on a 10-point scale. So they did not meet their the endpoint they were looking for. Any questions about this or anything that struck you guys from this about this study?
And Matt, you may not know the answer to this, but you're usually so good at checking into this. What on this particular scale was deemed clinically relevant? Do you remember what the...
They wanted at least more than a 1 point, but usually it's at least a 2 point difference, you know, like you want to see a 20 or 30% difference. In most medications studied for pain, and this goes way back to like our fibromyalgia episode, which was one of our first 10 episodes, most drugs do less than 2 points on a 10-point scale when you're talking about chronic pain. You know, it's different than if you give somebody like a handful of ibuprofen for like a sprained ankle, and you know, they might have more pain relief. But if you're taking it day in, day out, so yeah, this was certainly, you could argue, even if they did meet their 1 point between groups different, would that have been clinically significant to the patient?
Right.
Yeah. So good question. Rahul, anything from your end?
Yeah. I mean, you know, your framing of this as a negative trial, the gears are starting to turn in my brain. You know, could there have been sources of chance or bias that made this a false negative finding? I'm curious if there was anything in your overview of the paper that, you know, could lead us one way or another to think, could the study have been underpowered, for example? What were your thoughts about that?
You know, it was interesting that the study said they needed to enroll 80 some patients to achieve the power that they were looking for. They were looking to get 90% power, and the enrollment was delayed because of the pandemic, Paul. You'll love this. And then the patches and the placebo patches expired, I guess were donated for this. So they had to stop enrollment at only 76 patients. So, you know, that sort of handicap things a little bit. And then I think also, Paul and Rahul, the other thing that I noticed is that this was a crossover trial. So patients either started with placebo for 4 weeks, had a 1 week washout, then went to lidocaine, or they started with lidocaine and then did the washout, then went to placebo. And the group that started with placebo, it seemed like they were more likely to drop out from that group than they were if they started with lidocaine. And the blinding, although they said that they did some, they said the patches were, quote, identical in dimensions, texture, and smell, Paul.
How, but what about taste? Flawed study.
But I just question whether or not, like, that you had the more dropout in the placebo group after that first phase. I just wonder if patients could guess which group they were in and were just like, forget it. I'm not gonna stick with this. Rahul, anything else you saw? I know that there was a couple other things, but
yeah, these are the right things to be asking about. I mean, the strengths of this study, in my mind, the crossover design, very strong design for randomized trials. The fact that this was double blind is kind of what you want to see for studies where the outcome is sort of a subjective determination, like the experience of pain. And, you know, you also want to see that they have an adequate washout period between the study drug and placebo, which they had here. So all of these things, you know, kind of increase my confidence that this is likely to be just a true finding, that there is not really a benefit of topical lidocaine for mechanical neck pain. Yeah. Studies that are underpowered, you know, those tend to look different, where you see a point estimate that is, you know, on par with or bigger than what you powered the study for, but the confidence interval, you know, just missed statistical significance. That was not the case here. The effect size was, you know, I think 0.5 points different between the two that they actually found, and that difference didn't reach statistical significance. So all these findings increase my confidence in the determination that it's not so much that this was an underpowered study. I think it's just that there's really not evidence of a benefit of lidocaine here.
This episode is brought to you by Freed. An audience, you know, I'm a huge fan of Freed because Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. How many hours of your life have been stolen by the electronic health record, sitting there in your couch, in your pajamas, typing notes on your off hours? Get your life back. Gabby, a family medicine physician, and Arez, a computer engineer, came up with Freed as a solution that can help you alleviate that daily burden that you have as an overworked clinician. So Freed is there to help you. Freed is already loved by over 4,000 clinicians from every specialty. It's HIPAA compliant. It takes 30 seconds to learn. It costs only $99 a month. And let me tell you, your time is worth a lot more than $99 a month. So check it out. What have you got to lose? You can try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai. And listeners of the Curbsiders can use the code CURB50 for $50 off their first month. That's freed.ai. And use the code CURB50 for $50 off your first month. In part of why they were looking at neck pain, I just wanted to mention to the audience, because I know this is a common reason. So people commonly try to use lidocaine patches for low back pain, and that's been studied. There was at least 5 open label trials that were uncontrolled, and then there were 2 randomized trials of lidocaine patches for chronic low back pain. And the open label trials seemed favorable, but they weren't comparing it to anything. And then in the randomized trials, lidocaine and placebo, one of the trials performed the same, the lidocaine patches versus placebo. And in the other trial, it was a lidocaine and menthol patch versus placebo, maybe performed a little bit better. So maybe the smell there, Paul, didn't got it over the line against placebo. But I think that they were thinking, okay, it didn't work in the low back. Maybe that's because the tissues are, there's too much tissue there, can't penetrate enough, but the neck is like, there's less tissue to penetrate through. So maybe the lidocaine will be more effective in the neck. And there had been some other studies of neck pain that were with lidocaine patches that seemed like, oh, maybe there's something here. So I think that's why they were studying it.
No, it's a great thing to say. It's the neck gets short shrift because most of the data regarding the management of neck pain, at least with medications, is just extrapolated from low back pain. And mechanically, they suffer from different shear forces and have different issues entirely. So I'm actually thrilled that someone's actually looking specifically at neck pain. It's just a shame this was a negative study. Yeah.
And just looking at topical lidocaine in general, I mean, the lidocaine patches are approved for post-herpetic neuralgia officially, and that's really where the strength of evidence is. People in the guidelines for like diabetic neuropathy and things like that, it's mentioned as something you can use, but you know, so I think neuropathic pain is really where I'll be using lidocaine patches, and this won't change my practice. I would give this like 3.5 hotcakes. I thought it was commendable, as I said, that they published a negative study, and I like the fact that they're trying to look at something for neck pain. It's good to have randomized evidence that we can point to for something like this. And I, as Rahul said, I like the crossover design, especially for a placebo trial. It just seems like to make sense, you know, to see how much of a placebo effect a given patient had when you do that crossover like that. So, all right. Well, that's all I had on that one. So we have a couple hot takes to get to. And Rahul, our first hot take is, I don't know how to transition this from lidocaine from the neck to C. diff. So let's just, let's just get into it.
Not to think about it too much.
Yeah, yeah. Just all the puns sound dangerous here. Okay. So I am going to tell you all quickly about a paper that was published in Open Forum Infectious Diseases last year. This was a case control study that was looking at the strength of association between different classes of antibiotics and community-acquired C. diff infection. So previous studies on the strength of association between antibiotics and C. diff have all been really small and limited by different exposure windows. And so these authors sought to do a matched case control study using nationally representative data from insurance claims from the United States from 2001 to 2021. And they looked at patients who had outpatient diagnoses of C. diff and compared them to matched controls within the data set who did not have a diagnosis of C. diff during that time period. And they looked for exposure to 27 commonly used outpatient antibiotics. And this is the kind of study that you really do have to do a case control study for, because there's an outcome of interest, C. diff, and then many exposures of interest. So in this case, the groups were defined by the outcome, and they looked back in time to see what antibiotics they were exposed to. It's kind of cool. And the reason that this was limited to outpatients was because they wanted to really try and isolate the effect of the antibiotic on risk and remove kind of the other, you know, risks of C. diff that are kind of more related to hospitalization and inpatient stays. So basically what they found, the bottom line, was that there is a lot of variation, not only between antibiotic classes, but also within antibiotic classes in terms of risk for C. diff. And so it's really kind of too simple to say, you know, this class of antibiotics is better than this class. The details really matter. So I have a general takeaway that I'll tell you now. Before I tell you, did people have kind of a thought going in, like things you had heard were really bad in terms of C. diff, things you had heard were safe?
Well, Paul, I know your first love as an antibiotic, which you prescribe for everything, is clindamycin, much like gabapentin. I think that actually that's the combo. You prescribe gabapentin and clindamycin
and
for
clindamycin.
Everybody.
Combo pill. Yeah.
Right. So once you have diarrhea, you're much more likely to fall running to the bathroom. So it's really ideal.
So I know we talked about C. diff on an episode, and I believe it was with Paul Sachs, because he's the one that told us that part of the reason why doxycycline, one other additional reason why doxycycline is every ID doc's favorite antibiotic, is because it seems to be pretty C. diff friendly and maybe even has like a little inherent activity against C. diff. So I would have bet going into this that that was going to be the one that had the least, you know, least. But Rahul, tell us, what antibiotics came out looking bad and which ones looked good in this regard?
Yeah. So you already kind of knew about the clindamycin bad, doxy good sort of mantra. But what they found, the antibiotics that had the highest risk or highest odds of association with C. diff, and we're talking odds ratios in the 10 to 20 range, clindamycin and later generation cephalosporins. Okay. Those seem to be the worst. The next level of risk, odds ratios of between 5 and 10, these are your fluoroquinolones and actually penicillins. Amoxicillin clavulanic acid fell in this category. So something that I previously thought of as kind of safe, you know, actually is kind of moderate risk. Lower risk antibiotics, odds ratios of 1 to 3, sulfonamides and macrolides. Also kind of surprising to me that, you know, macrolides are not as high risk as I always kind of thought. And then antibiotics with really no or minimal risk, odds ratios of 1 or in some cases even less, the tetracyclines. And kind of curious finding minocycline, which I've never used that, actually had a significantly protective odds ratio for C. diff. So maybe there's some role for minocycline in treatment, who knows. But kind of a cool little granularity to our clin to bad, doxy good.
And the two things that struck me from this, you mentioned the cephalosporins. So you don't really think of, at least I didn't really think of, the later generation cephalosporins as being so C. diff unfriendly. And then the other thing, Rahul, was this time from antibiotic exposure. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because I think that was significant as well.
Yeah. Yeah. The cephalosporin piece brings up an important limitation of this study, which is they really don't have data on kind of the more inpatient antibiotics, because this was all, diagnoses established in the outpatient setting. So we can't really make conclusions about people getting ceftriaxone, cefepime, et cetera. But the time from exposure piece. So one of the cool things about this study, causal inference is really limited from a case control study. This is sort of thought to be one of the weakest types of study designs for causal inference. But they did do a cool thing, which was they varied the exposure window. The primary analysis was receipt of antibiotics within 30 days of the C. diff diagnosis. And then they did a sensitivity analysis looking at longer windows, 60 days, 90 days, 120, all the way out to 180 days. And you would expect that as you get farther away from the receipt of antibiotics and your C. diff diagnosis, that association should weaken. And that's exactly what they saw. The odds ratios for every antibiotic decreased the longer out you looked. So kind of a cool piece of causal inference buried in this paper, and suggests that these relationships probably are causal, and it highlights a limitation of previous studies, which is that inconsistent exposure windows. You really do need to be looking at antibiotics within a short duration preceding the C. diff diagnosis.
Yeah, so people should definitely bookmark this one so they can look at that table with the 27 antibiotics, so they can kind of see how they rank when they're deciding which cephalosporin to prescribe for people, or just trying to figure out which antibiotics you're prescribing, especially if someone has a history of C. diff.
Yeah.
So the last thing we wanted to talk about here, Paul, to set this up, Paul, are you having trouble prescribing GLP-1 agonists, or we'll lump in the GIP/GLP-1 agonist tirzepatide? Are you having trouble right now prescribing them, or with your patients actually getting them?
Yeah, I was going to say, no problems at all prescribing it. It's just my patients can't pick it up or find any sources of it. So yeah, there's been a lot of manufacturer shortages and specific doses too. So it's been a real challenge to prescribe these with any kind of consistency.
Right. The genesis of this topic was a listener on our Discord mentioned, asked Paul and I a question, are you seeing people locally that are dosing the GLP-1 agonist semaglutide by clicks? And Paul and I were like, what? I've never heard of that before. Paul actually put out a Twitter poll that got, 200 some votes. And about half of the people, a little more than half of the people, had never heard of this practice of dosing by clicks. And a little less than 10% said they actually do this. Some people said they heard of it, but don't do it. So it was
higher number than I expected. Like the 9% that are actually doing it, I was kind of surprised by.
Yeah. So I guess that was 34% of people that are, either heard of it or are actually doing it, 34-35%, based on that poll. And I had never heard of this. So there actually was an article, someone has actually published about this outside of Reddit, which was where I initially found most of the information, Paul. There's a Reddit thread.
It's my main source of medical information, actually.
Yeah. Well, I should say, first I came across Budget Ozempic, Paul, which was just people recommending on TikTok that you take, if you can't afford Ozempic, sorry for saying the brand name, that you should just take a bunch of laxatives and that will that will help you lose weight. So don't
do
that.
That's great medical advice.
Sure.
Then I found the Reddit thread, which actually in the Reddit thread, there was a link to this Canadian doctor. He shared the PDF of this handout he gives to patients telling them how to dose by clicks. And then I found this paper by Whitley et al. It's a bunch of pharmacists. It's a special report that appeared in Clinical Diabetes in the summer of 2023, just talking about how do we handle this shortage of GLP-1 and the GIP/GLP-1 agonists that are out there. And the interesting thing about semaglutide pens is that they're multi-dose pens. And so let's say, Paul, someone has the 1 milligram pen. Well, they have to turn this dial on it a bunch of times until it gets to the 1 milligram dose. So someone figured out that, well, if you count how many clicks it takes to get to 1 milligram, then, you know, if you give half that many clicks, maybe you can give half the dose. Paul, you're putting your head in your hands and your thoughts as America's primary care physician?
The American healthcare system is deeply and fundamentally broken is my thought, basically.
Yeah. So these pharmacists were, you know, these pharmacists were just mentioning potential strategies of like, if they know they're not going to be able to get a refill because of the shortage, do they take it every other week? Or if they have a pen, do they dose by clicks and maybe they take a smaller dose? Or they even said, if some people are having side effects, you know, if they have a 1 milligram pen and they're having side effects, maybe they don't click it all the way up. They just click it partway up and then take a smaller dose. So it was coming from a practical place. And they actually have a table in there in this paper that's just talking about how many clicks. So it's, Paul, how many clicks do you think it takes to get to, I feel like this is a Tootsie Pop commercial. Yeah.
How many clicks to the center of an Ozempic pen?
How many total clicks to the 1 milligram dose?
Supposedly, the number of clicks is the same across all pens to get to the max, to get to the top dose.
Feels unlikely.
I know.
But it's a bunch, right? It's like 76 clicks for the full dose, and then
so
like
I found
three
one source. They published 74 clicks to get to the full dose. So if you want to, let's say someone has a 1 milligram pen, just to make the math easy for us, Paul, 74 clicks, that'll get them 1 milligram, 37 clicks, that will get them half a milligram. And then you can scale down or up, you know, as you want based on, you know, give them 18 clicks if you want them to get like a quarter of a dose, basically. So it's interesting. It's not something that I necessarily am going to be telling my patients to do, but it might be something that people come in asking you about. And what our listener, Scott, on Discord was actually mentioning was that this was a budget thing where if you prescribe someone a 1 milligram pen and they do 18 clicks, you know, then that pen can last them for many more weeks than if they were doing the full 74 clicks for each dose.
And to be clear, I just sort of like, I'm casting no shade on the patients who are doing this and the people who are actually trying to help them. Like, this is clearly just an issue from a system standpoint. So all my agonal eye rolling and stuff, if this can actually be seen by anyone who watches the video, is not directed towards the people doing this, because it just seems like a necessary evil after we start this chronic medication that has you rebound from if you stop taking. Like, this is just, it's a shame that our system is so flawed that we actually have to revert to these kind of tactics. So I just want to make sure that people don't take my criticisms as directed towards patients or the people trying to help them, which is not what I'm rolling my eyes at.
Yeah. And I mean, let's say we had a perfect supply. I think where I'd be interested in this is if somebody is on a pen and they're having a lot of side effects and they're like, how can you help me with this? And you tell them, okay, click it up, but don't click it up the full way. That's potentially something you could do. But again, you'd have to confirm how many clicks it takes to get to the full dose. Because I'm just not 100% that, you know, it's really going to be 74 clicks on all the pens. But anyway, that I thought this was kind of a neat thing. I did look, and you know, this is coming out the end of March. I've been told by a local pharmacist, they're thinking the end of April or May that they might be able to get more of a supply of this. And in Forbes, I found an article talking about how the drug companies are trying to ramp up production. I guess this has been an issue since the end of 2022 and it persisted through 2023. So, they apparently are trying to ramp up production. It should get better because a lot of patients do need and benefit from these medications. So hopefully it will. And, that's all I have to say about it. Rahul, any comments, concerns, questions about this one?
Yeah, I mean, I could see if it's for side effects, like titrating down. I mean, that could be part of like a good strategy for, you know, achieving kind of the minimum tolerated dose. But if it's, you know, for budgeting and for kind of rationing, you know, for drugs that exhibit a threshold effect, you know, that could be bad if you kind of, you know, drop below the level of what's effective in a patient.
Right.
So right. It kind of depends why somebody would be doing it, but it's a great illustration of, you know, knowing how patients are using medications, especially when it's in ways that we might not know about or might not be thinking about. So it's great to know.
And that reminded me, I should mention that the dulaglutide and tirzepatide pens have a single dose. You know, you can't dose by clicks with those pens. This is specifically the semaglutide pens, which I guess their mechanism is that they have those clicks to get to the set dose. So you can't do this with every single GLP-1 or GIP/GLP-1 agonist. All right. Well, any closing comments? I think we've done it. It's been a great show, as always, and it's probably time for an outro, Paul.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
Oh, that one did it for me. Still hungry for more? Join our Patreon and get all of our episodes ad-free, plus twice monthly bonus episodes at patreon.com/curbsiders. You can find our show notes at thecurbsiders.com and sign up for our mailing list to get our weekly show notes in your inbox. This includes our Curbsiders Digest, which recaps the latest practice-changing articles, guidelines, and news in internal medicine.
And we're committed to high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So you can email us at askcurbsiders@gmail.com. It also helps us a lot and makes us feel good about ourselves when you subscribe, rate, and review the show on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME for all health professionals through VCU Health at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. I wanted to give a special thanks to Rahul and Paul for helping to write and produce this episode, and to our whole team. Our technical production is done by Podpaste. Elizabeth Proto is on social media. Jen Watto runs our Patreon. Chris the Chew Man Chew moderates our Discord. Stuart Brigham composed the theme music. And with all that, until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
I've been Dr. Rahul Bhavant Ganatra.
And as always, our main Dr. Paul Nelson Williams, thank you and goodbye.